Until now, we've been talking about the two primary grounds for suppressing a statement, which are involuntariness and Miranda. And those are the ones you're going to be using most often. But there are also other grounds that you need to be aware of and that you need to consider in appropriate cases. There's a long list, but let me tell you about a few of the most important and most common. One is that in most jurisdictions, there is a statute or a court rule or common law that creates special procedures for interrogating juveniles. And those special procedures, if violated, may provide a ground for suppression. Second, there is a ground for suppression under the federal constitutional right to counsel and under corollary parallel state constitutional guarantees of a right to counsel. Third, if you litigate a Fourth Amendment claim that your client was unlawfully seized in a Terry stop or an arrest that violated the Fourth Amendment or parallel provisions of the state constitution, that Fourth Amendment or search and seizure state constitutional violation can provide a ground for suppressing a statement as a fruit of the poisonous tree. Fourth, several jurisdictions have created a rule, either by statute or by common law, that requires that when the police interrogate a juvenile, that a parent be present. And they sometimes call that the interested parent rule. And that rule, if violated, can constitute a ground for suppressing a statement. And fifth, there's something called the cat out of the bag doctrine, which allows you to suppress a statement as a fruit of a previously taken unconstitutional statement. So let's talk a little bit about each one of those. And there may be other ones in your jurisdiction that provide additional grounds or alternative grounds. But let's talk about these because these are some of the ones that are most commonly found around the country. So let's start out with the statutory requirements for interrogations of juveniles. These don't exist everywhere, but lots of states have these special rules. In some places they're in statutes, in other places they're in court rules. In some places they may be in common law that require that the police follow special procedures when interrogating a juvenile. In terms of talking about this, it's really easiest if I use one particular state, and so I hope you'll indulge me if I use the state I know the most about, which is the one which my clinic practices, which is New York. So in New York, we have this Family Court Act statute, section 305.2 of the Family Court Act, and it specifies the procedures for interrogating juveniles. And 305.2 subpart 3 says that police have the obligation to promptly notify a parent or guardian after arresting a juvenile. And what we've done with that is we've turned that into a suppression doctrine. And we've gotten the courts to hold that if the police do not promptly notify the parents or guardians of a kid, that their failure to do so is a ground for suppressing the confession under FCA 305.2 subpart 3. And if you've got parental notification rules in your jurisdiction, you could do the same thing. 305.2 subpart 4 requires that police interrogations of juveniles take place in a special juvenile interrogation room. And there again, we've gotten the courts to hold that if that procedure is violated, that is a ground for suppressing a statement. Same thing with 305.2 subpart 7, which requires that the police advise not only the juvenile, but also a parent or guardian, if present, of the kid's Miranda rights. Again, basis for suppression if violated. So look for these statutory and rule protections, and then use them and turn them into real protections. All right. Now, I also mentioned the right to counsel. Under the federal and parallel provisions of the state constitutions, under the right to counsel, if the police violate the right to counsel in taking a statement, then that's a ground for suppression. The problem is this doesn't come up so much in the federal constitutional cases because the federal constitutional right to counsel does not attach until adversarial proceedings commence. And that's defined as the arraignment or sometimes a pre-arraignment preliminary hearing. And so this really doesn't come up except in cases where counsel has already been appointed and thereafter the police try to interrogate the suspect. It usually comes up if they try to interrogate the suspect about some new crime and unfortunately, the right to counsel is offense-specific under a case called McNeil v. Wisconsin, which means that the triggering of the right to counsel in one case by appointing counsel at arraignment does not mean that the police are foreclosed from questioning the person in the next case about this other case, even though they're already appointed counsel in an ongoing case. So that's why right to counsel doesn't come up that much under the federal constitution. But we've been very successful in New York in broadening this state constitutional right to counsel. And of course, you are always able to ask a court, a state court, to construe its state constitution more broadly than the federal. And what we've been able to do is we've been able to convince the state courts in New York to hold that the state constitutional right to counsel is triggered whenever a lawyer or their professional associate calls the police station and says that they've been retained by the family to represent the accused. And for a minor, that even works if the parent calls. Although for an adult, it's got to be the lawyer or their professional associate. So what that means is, under a 1986 case called Moran v. Burbine of the U.S. Supreme Court, where the lawyer called the station and said, my client is now represented. I am his lawyer. I've been retained by the family. Don't question him. And unfortunately, the defendant had already waived Miranda rights. The police had not questioned the defendant yet, and the police misled the lawyer and told the lawyer the defendant is not here, and then they questioned the defendant. And the issue for the U.S. Supreme Court was, does the lawyer saying, I am representing the defendant, trigger the right to counsel? And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, because under the federal constitution, only at the commencement of adversarial proceedings does the right to counsel attach. And adversarial proceedings had not commenced yet because arraignment had not yet happened. Now, in New York, we have a case called People v. Grice from 2003. And Grice holds that if a lawyer or a professional associate calls the police station, like what happened at Moran v. Burbine, that is enough to trigger the state constitutional right to counsel and to cut off questioning. We also have a rule in New York that if the defendant requests counsel, that's enough to trigger the state constitutional right to counsel. So you can see there's a real big growth area for you if your courts have not yet construed the state constitution in this way and if there's some leeway to do so. All right, so that's two of the grounds. Another ground, as I mentioned, is that some states by statute or rule or by common law have created this interested parent rule, which says that the parent of a minor must be present when the police interrogate a minor. And that, too, can be a ground for suppression in those jurisdictions. Another factor, as I mentioned, another claim, is a Fourth Amendment claim. And if you can show that your client was unlawfully seized, in other words, if there was an unlawful Terry stop in violation of the Terry standards, or if there was an unlawful seizure of the person requiring probable cause, namely an arrest or some lesser seizure, which nonetheless was a seizure requiring probable cause because it was more than a Terry stop, and if the police lacked the requisite grounds for that, so if they lacked for a Terry stop, reasonable grounds to believe that criminal activity is afoot and that this individual is involved in it, or for an arrest, they lacked probable cause to believe that a crime had been committed and that this individual committed the crime. If they lacked that justification, the seizure of the person was unlawful on Fourth Amendment grounds, and then any subsequent statement elicited from that suspect can be suppressed as a fruit of the illegal seizure of the person. And then the last category that I mentioned to you was cat out of the bag. And this is another type of fruits analysis, but it's a statement suppression fruits analysis that results in suppression of a statement as a result of the taking of a different statement. So let's suppose the police take a statement and it's suppressed. And we have to talk about what the ground is for suppression. So if the first statement is suppressed on involuntariness grounds, on the ground that the statement was coerced, then the coercion can carry over and render the second statement suppressed as well on the ground that the coercion carries over and there was no break in the circumstances of such length or of such magnitude as to dissipate the taint of the coercion. And that would result in the second statement being suppressed as a fruit of the coerced first statement. Now, there used to be a doctrine called cat out of the bag, which results in statements being suppressed on the theory that once a defendant has made a statement once unconstitutionally, now the cat is out of the bag, and there's no reason for the accused not to confess again, and that if you suppress only the first statement and not the second, you're allowing the police to get the benefit of their own misconduct. Unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court has cut back on that. In a case called Oregon v. Elstad, it said that the cat out of the bag doctrine will not produce suppression of the second statement as a fruit of the first if the first one was suppressed on Miranda grounds, only if it will only work if the first statement was suppressed on involuntariness grounds and was therefore unreliable and untrustworthy. So, what about in Miranda cases? What happens? Well, what happens there is they're governed by a U.S. Supreme Court decision that was handed down in 2004 called Missouri versus Siebert, S-E-I-B-E-R-T. And in Siebert, the Missouri police used this trick that they'd been using regularly, in which they first take a statement from a suspect without Miranda warnings. And therefore, they get a confession because the defendant has not been warned not to confess. And then, after the defendant has confessed, then the police Mirandize the individual and say, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, and then ask if the defendant wants to talk. At that point, the defendant figures, well, my first statement can be used against me in a court of law, so therefore, why not talk? Because they've already got me. Well, in Siebert, what happened was the U.S. Supreme Court said that this two-stage procedure, as used in Siebert, was unconstitutional. Unfortunately, the rule that comes out of Siebert is not as good as the one we would want. What happened was it was a 5-4 decision, and the plurality, Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, say they announce an elaborate protective system for this kind of situation. And they say the second statement will be suppressed as the fruit of the first one unless, and then they look at various factors, unless you do a totality of the circumstances analysis in which you look at whether or not the police personnel were the same, whether or not the police gave adequate warnings in between to help the defendant understand that the first statement can't be used, and therefore the defendant is free to remain silent, and whether or not they exploited the first statement in any way. So it's an intricate, very protective model. Unfortunately, it was only the plurality that adopted it. The fifth justice joining in the majority was Justice Kennedy, and he joined them on a narrower ground. And under the jurisprudence of U.S. Supreme Court decision making, the narrowest ground for decision that commands a majority is the holding of the court, where there is no single rationale that commands the views of all five justices in the majority. And so, and that's a rule that comes out of a case called Marks v. United States. So what that means is that Justice Kennedy's decision, which was a concurrence, is the controlling decision. And what he said was that it is essential that the defendant understand that the first statement will not necessarily be used, but that can be achieved by a protracted break in time between the two statements and a re-Mirandizing of the defendant. Or it could be done by a fuller explanation that the first statement is not available. But under Kennedy's analysis, a sufficient break in time with the re-Mirandizing can be enough to allow the police to get the benefit of the second statement. Now, that too may be an area where you can establish a state constitutional rule. There too, in New York, we have a more protective rule under the state constitution. So if there's a take-home message for you here, it is to look for every possible claim that you can raise and look for them not only in the federal constitution, but also in the state constitution, also in the statutes, also in the court rules, also in the common law on non-constitutional grounds. And if there is no protection adequate for your case, then think about a way to try to create a new one under the state constitution.